Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's Bill Arnold with you today. I'm so glad to be here. It is already Monday. I hope your weekend was good. In the upper Midwest, we were scorching hot. I tell you, I was one sweaty guy. So I hope you are off to a good start this week. I'm awfully glad you're here with me this afternoon. You know, I was just kind of doing some odds and ends over the weekend. I was poking around on the internet yesterday. I was on Bigfoot's website. It turns out he doesn't believe in me either. So that sort of makes sense in a strange sort of way. You know, we're going to be talking about movies a little bit later in the next hour. And there was a movie that came out with John Travolta this weekend, the new movie about John Gotti. So I don't think we're going to talk about that because there's nothing to talk about. It got a 0% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. I think that movie is so bad they're thinking of have Travolta serve out the remainder of Gotti's sentence. Now, that would make sense to me. Anyway, we've got a great show. Dr. Mark Rutland's going to be with us in just a minute. He has written 15 books, and his latest book is called David the Great, Deconstructing the Man After God's Own Heart. So I'm very excited about that. And you know on this show, I love Scripture and lots of it. So I want a million people reading Scripture on my show. I don't collect autographs. I collect people reading Scripture. That's what I want. So here is a John, I think you'll recognize this as John 1, read by my friend Mike from the Bible study.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made.
Giving hope to believers through relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching is why, in part, that Faith Radio exists. Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. When you pray and support this ministry, you ensure that the truth of God's Word will continue to go forth from this ministry. So whether it's over the air, online, through our mobile app, or through our on-demand programming, the good news of Jesus is being proclaimed. Join us today with a gift at MyFaithRadio.com.
Your prayers matter and are heard by God. When you pray, lives can be changed. Each week, the Faith Radio prayer team joins together to pray for relationships to be strengthened, finances to be increased for God's glory, for our leaders to follow God's will, and for so much more. Will you join us? The Faith Radio prayer team, made up of hundreds of listeners, receives an email with each week's prayer focus. You can be a part of the Faith Radio prayer team by signing up at MyFaithRadio.com.
It is 7 minutes after the hour. You know, King David was a complicated man, for sure. I think sometimes we look at him in a way like that shepherd boy on a Sunday school felt board. And he is way more complicated than that. And if we only look at that and neglect one of the most complex stories of sin and redemption, we're going to miss a lot about David. And we're going to talk to Dr. Mark Rutland about his new book, David the Great, Deconstructing the Man After God's Own Heart. Dr. Mark Rutland is a New York Times bestselling author and columnist for Ministry Today magazine, and he's with us on our studio line right now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Bill. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. You've written 15 books. You've got 3 kids and 9 grandkids, so you're ahead in the book department.
I'm ahead in the book department. You know, 9 grandchildren. Whatever money your children didn't spend, your grandchildren take care of it.
Exactly. Now, because it's the summertime, and I love summertime, I want you to take me back to the summertime in your youth when you were at Blue Lake, Alabama. Tell me what happened.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. I don't know how in the world you would know about that. But, yeah, that's where I got saved. I was a wild buck high school quarterback, and wild as a March hare. I had gone through a little legal trouble in the summer. We had a youth director at our church that found out about it. I didn't want him to tell my parents, so he blackmailed me into going to church camp. And so I arrived angry, out of sorts, and rebellious, and that's where I got saved.
That's fantastic. And tell me the message you heard. Tell me what happened the night and what moved in your spirit.
Yeah, there was an evangelist. You know, I was a teenager, so mm-hmm. he looked to me like he was ancient. He was a real old guy. He was
like
probably 10 or 15 years. Yeah, probably younger, 20 years younger than I am now.
Right.
But he preached a simple message on life as a baseball game, and he talked about that. I was an athlete. I liked the sound of it. It was athletic and energetic, and he was energetic, and he talked about hitting a ball into the gap in the outfield, and you round first base, and you come to second base. Second base is popularity, and third base is success. And he named all these things, and then he said, you know, you're coming in at the end of your life, and the throw is coming in from the outfield, and you slide in, and you beat the throw. And the catcher applies the tag, but it's too late. But the umpire leans over in your face and yells, "You're out." Well, I was back in the back row. I was already angry over being made to be there. And then I thought, well, this is not fair. You said I beat the throw. And he said, you jump up, you're angry, you yell at the umpire, "I beat the throw, I beat the throw." And he says, "Yeah, but you didn't touch first base."
Hmm.
And it was this very simple message. And talked about, first base is,
right,
is the Lord. And it was just the kind of simple, down-to-earth message that would appeal to a high school boy, and I got saved.
I
wonder how you knew all about all that.
Well,
that's amazing.
I'm never going to give up my secrets, Mark, so just so you know. But I just think it's great because, it's summertime now, and kids are going off to summer camps, and I just think it's a great encouragement to let, just remind everybody that powerful things happen in the lives of kids when they go to summer camp.
Yeah, that's right. And I think even if you blackmail one into going to summer camp, I think it's worth it,
I agree. However they get there, it doesn't matter as long as they get there.
That's it.
Well, congratulations on your new book, David the Great, Deconstructing the Man After God's Own Heart. Tell me, what inspired you to write this one?
Thank you. I appreciate it very much. It's really taken off like a shot. I'm absolutely thrilled with it. Two things inspired me, really. I had, through the years, I've been in the ministry 50 years now, and through the years I've probably preached, taught, and lectured at two different universities that are where I was the president, and several universities where I was just invited to lecture on the life of King David to millennials. And it just hit. They just loved it. I packed out audiences, and I kept getting requests, write the book. And so 2 years ago, I came out with a book that did real well called 21 Seconds to Change Your World, which was about the Lord's Prayer in the 23rd Psalm. And so writing about the Psalm, then I began to feel that the next step was finally to pull this book together on David. And it just one of those things. It just hit. So we thank God.
Amen. So let's talk about the King David in the Bible, because there are a lot of people that think of the shepherd boy, and it's way more complicated than that.
Absolutely, David was a complex, multifaceted genius. David would have been put into any era of time, including our own, and he would have been one of those remarkable human beings. He was a giant. He was a genius in diverse genres that are seemingly mutually exclusive. He was a genius at war, a genius, to be blunt, he was a genius at killing. He was strategic. I did some research one time and finally quit on it. I was going to compute how many people either David killed personally or were killed by his extended agencies, his armies or soldiers or whatever. When I got into the tens of thousands, I just dropped it.
Wow.
But David lived. David was, people don't grasp when he lived. David lived 1,000 years before Christ, 3,000 years ago. He was right at the end of the Bronze Age. So he lived in a violent age of conquest and reconquest and war and civil war. He lived through multiple wars and two civil wars, and he just lived in a violent age. But you don't expect that guy then to write heart-rending poetry that will still be beloved three millennia later.
Yeah, boy, you put it that way.
Yeah, he was also a musical genius. He wrote, composed. He was a poet. He was a child prodigy. As far as we know from Scripture, we can't prove the negative, but it is not mentioned anybody else in his family had any musical talent. David was a child prodigy. They sent him out in the pasture to tend sheep, and he came back playing the guitar like Johnny B. Good.
I'm starting to feel threatened by this guy.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like him.
I mean, he's the lion in every room, and you are no – that's interesting you say that, because there are so many people that were threatened, envious, didn't know what to think of him, beloved of women, and admired by men and hated by men.
Yeah.
He was a complex human being.
Uh-huh. So whatever room he was in, he was probably the best in most fields.
Yes. He was the lion in every room.
Yeah.
And his whole life. And he was threatening. What you expressed, that is exactly what his father-in-law felt.
Yeah.
And the minute Saul laid eyes on him, he felt this kid is dangerous.
Yeah. And I'm sure he hosted an afternoon radio show and was way better than me, too.
I don't know. It doesn't mention an afternoon radio show. But
well, maybe you didn't do enough research, Mark. Probably in there somewhere.
Yeah, I left that part out. I left that part out.
All right. You wanted to de-comic book David. Now, explain what that means.
Well, as part of, like what you said in your introduction, everybody has this sort of felt board view of David. The curly-headed little kid with the slingshot.
Mm-hmm.
But that turns him into a one-dimensional caricature of himself. I had a fascinating experience the other day. I was in the Barnes & Noble in the children's section looking for a book for my grandson. And there was a father and son in there, and they were kneeling down looking at the picture books, a little boy. And he picked out one that said David and Goliath. And he said to his dad, "What's this?" And his dad said, "You know, it's like Jack and the Beanstalk." And I was just horrified.
Yeah.
I want you to know I resisted the impulse to preach, but I had to go out to my car to get over it. But that's what I want. I didn't want people to know two things about David. Even people that are pretty sophisticated biblically, Bill, they know David and Goliath, and they know David and Bathsheba.
And I would say, Mark, that they don't even know the David and Goliath story very accurately. And they assume that David was, you know, scared to take on Goliath.
Yes, they don't know that story. They know neither story very accurately, and they don't know anything that went on between or after. I mean, David died when he was 70, which is not extraordinarily old, but he jammed 250 years of living into that 70.
Mm-hmm.
His life is an incredibly complex story. People talk about rags to riches. David's life was not rags to riches. It was rags to riches to rags to riches to rags to riches.
Mm-hmm. All right.
An incredible roller coaster.
Yeah. Mark, let me take a very short break, and then when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Mark Rutland, author of the book David the Great, Deconstructing the Man After God's Own Heart. And lucky you, we've got a couple copies of the book that if you want to get in the drawing to get one, you can email me, bill@myfaithradio.com. When you do that, make sure you put your name and your address, very important because we need to know where to send it, if we do the drawing and you become the winner. So we'll take a short break and come back in just a minute. It is 19 minutes after the hour. Glad you're listening today. We've got David. David the Great is the book we're talking about today with Dr. Mark Rutland. He is the author of it. This is his 15th book. It's a very easy conversational style of reading. Once you pick it up, make sure you've got food and beverage because you won't want to move until you get through a lot of it because it's so it reads so nicely. Nice work, Mark. Really nice job. Let's get back to David and his what you call his gritty side.
Yes, David was a man, you know. I mean, he was a real person. When I was working on this book, I was in Israel, as a matter of fact, in Tiberias, and I was writing at an outdoor picnic table, and an Israeli lady asked me what I was writing about, and I said, King David. This is an Israeli woman in Israel. I said, King David, and she backed up and got a sneer on her face, and she said, why would you write about that bloody man? And she turned around and walked off. And I thought, what manner of man is this that after 3,000 years can still make a woman that angry? this is a tough guy, and he's a kind of guy, he's a man's man. That's the reason this book is going over so big with men. He's a man's man. This is the kind of guy you want to take deer hunting with you.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you might not want him to take your wife deer hunting. He yielded to his carnality at times. The story with Bathsheba is, there are people who know the phrase David and Bathsheba, and they think it's from Shakespeare.
Right.
But it was an affair. It was a terrible affair. It led him to the cover-up, which was worse than the affair. He tried to palm his baby off on a friend. When that didn't work, he killed a friend. And it was just a nightmare. David, but that is not even David's most destructive sin. Most people, even biblical Christians, think that's the worst sin. David's most destructive sin was a census. Because of the affair with Bathsheba, only two people died that we know of, Uriah and the baby. But David, against the command of God, took a census, which was forbidden because they didn't want Israel. God didn't want Israel's kings to be narcissistic and egotistical. He said, just whatever people you have, they're yours. But David took the census, and as a result, God struck Israel with a plague, and 70,000 people died. So, I mean, David's not a guy without some blots on his name.
Yeah, I would say.
He's complex.
Yeah. Of course, Mark, that leads me to my next question. So how can the Bible, call him a man after God's own heart with all of this grit?
That's the question, Bill.
Perfect. Okay. All right, good.
You're right on. That's actually the question. Samuel calls David a man after God's own heart, but it's before we meet him. Samuel says that to Saul, David's predecessor. He says, God is going to take the kingdom away from you and give it to a man after his own heart. So we might say, okay, maybe we didn't know who David was then. The problem is St. Paul in the book of Acts, 1,000 years after David's death. We know everything. We know all the ups and downs. We know all the dirt as well as the glory. And Paul says not only that David was a man after God's own heart, he adds, God testifies of this man. He is a man after my own heart. And then he says, and from him will come Messiah. So now it means God knows everything. History knows everything. The Bible knows everything. And he's still a man after God's own heart.
Mm-hmm.
So, do we say to these things?
Yeah, Mark, if we're having a conversation with somebody who may not know the Bible very well, and we, have a discussion with King David, and they find out that he was an adulterer and a murderer and all this, how do we sell it that he was a man after God's own heart if we're talking to someone who doesn't know a lot about Scripture?
That's the key issue. That is what drove me with the book, and I believe it's this. There was something in David so fixed on God. Goethe says a good man in his darkest aberrations is conscious of the right way still. Something in David, even when he failed, even when he fell, was still fastened on God. David, I see David as one of these powerful running backs on an American football team.
Mm-hmm.
They get through the line. They come at you in the deep secondary. Okay, maybe you can get them down, but they're going to fall forward for 3.5 yards. Furthermore, you've only got them down temporarily. They're going to get up and come at you again and again because they're focused on that goal line. They're so fixed on that end zone that all you do is fight a delaying war. And I believe David was like that. He was so fastened on God. Even when he fell at the feet of God. Well, so that speaks to us.
Mm, yeah.
God says, I'm not asking you to be perfect. I'm just asking if you fall, fall at the foot of the cross.
Yeah. Mark, you know, you talk about David as a man's man. Talk a little bit about his beginnings. Would he have been bullied as a boy? Was he kind of a strange kid?
That's another very good question. David was he was bullied, I think, but he was bullied by his big brothers.
yeah, that usually happens anyway.
Yeah, it does. David was the youngest of eight boys in an agrarian household. The other seven were all pretty much grown when David was born. David was the proverbial accident, you know, oops. And he was really not worth much, so they sent him out to tend the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back in. Look, your youngest child comes in. He says, a lion came today. A lion, what'd you do? I punched him with my little fist and killed him. And the next day, what happened? A bear came. What'd you do? I punched him and killed him. I mean, they thought he was a weird little kid at best and maybe a pathological liar.
Yeah. Yeah, because who does that?
That's the reason. Yeah.
You know he's got a hand-me-down tunic and he's out punching bears? Come on.
Exactly. when he appears at Saul's army camp to take food to his brothers and Goliath comes out to taunt the army of Israel. When David steps forward to face the challenge, Eliab, his older brother, says, the King James word sounds a little bit prissy, but he says, I know the naughtiness of thine heart. In other words, he says, I know what a wicked little brat you are. So they feel David's inner heart is wrong, and that's why he tells these things. But God says his inner heart is right, and that's why he does these things.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I just have about 90 seconds left. What about David's life most encouraged you?
It is this, the God of David. If you read this book or you read the story of David and you only know that David was a great man, I failed. But David served a great God, a God of mercy and of grace and of judgment and of power and of terror and of wonder. The God of David is a great God. Mm. And that's the number one takeaway of David's life.
Oh, wow. You actually made me love God more just in this interview. How is that
good.
Possible? Yeah. Yeah. And just good. With a minute left, what was the hardest chapter in this book for you to write?
The hardest chapter for me to write was the last one. How do we deal with the issue? How do we deal with that issue of why is this guy a man after God's own heart? And I just struggled with it. And what I finally came to is there was something inside David that God adored.
Oh.
And I believe it was that someplace in David, he was fixed on God, even when he fell, because his confession was public. They wrote Psalm 51 and memorialized it. Mm. Most people want to sweep our sins under the rug.
Yeah.
David said, I want people to read about it.
Mark, fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. David the Great, Deconstructing the Man After God's Own Heart, is Dr. Mark Rutland's newest book. I highly recommend it. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It was a joy.
Thanks so much. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
For recording artist Jafia Life, following Christ has meant focusing on three specific areas of his life. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas, and Jafia tells us how doing this has changed his relationship with God.
One thing that God showed me when I transitioned out of a lifestyle of sin, it was really that I needed to focus on people, places, and things. The people that I hang around, the things that I do, and the places that I go.
Jafia says that God provided opportunities for him to grow in those very areas of his life.
Once you make a decision to follow God, it's like a domino effect. It really is, because he'll put people in your life to help guide you and walk you to the next step. You know, I remember people being put in my life that I could decide to walk with into a new life.
Now that is a great illustration of how God guides us when we choose to follow him. For more encouragement in your walk with God, go to makingyourlifecount.com.
It is 32 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here with you. You know, it's the second time Dr. Adam Carrington has been on Faith Radio today, so we are buying Adam Carrington in bulk today and passing the savings on to you. How are you,
yeah,
Adam?
Well, I'm doing well, and I think the going price, it's a buyer's, not a seller's market on me. So.
It could be. Well, how was your Father's Day?
It was very good.
Nice.
Very good. Where our daughter is just over a year old and is just a lot of fun and brings plenty of joy to me. So it was a really good day, and I have a wonderful father as well. So I was able to experience it as a father and as a son, which was pretty special.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations. And usually in the morning we talk top of the mind news stories, but today I want to talk about something quite passionate for you and something you teach about at Hillsdale College, is where you work, and that's Shakespeare.
Yes, which it's strange that many people might think it's strange that I teach politics and I love Shakespeare.
I know.
But yes, they actually let me teach a class here that's very popular called Politics and Literature.
Mm-hmm.
It tries to intersect those two disciplines and see how they can talk to each other. And the way I have taught it the last two times I've taught it has been to basically teach all plays of William Shakespeare as a way to get at some of the big questions of politics. So it's a very popular class here, and I've really enjoyed teaching it and have thought a lot about it as a result.
Yeah, now I know we don't have a lot of time today, but I want to start with a beginner's course as to give me an example of what this would look like.
Sure. I think the thing to understand is to say a little bit about what it means to study politics. And studying politics really is studying what it means to live life together with justice under laws. And that is a part of what human beings are like. It's a part of their story. And good plays, good literature, tells a good story. And why is it a good story? Because it's true to life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Shakespeare tells stories that include true-to-life descriptions of kings, of rulers, of citizens, of discussions within them of what justice is, of what a good law is, of what nature and convention, how they interact with what's good, of revenge, ambition, all these things that we see come to life in politics so much. And so what I try to do when I teach it is I usually pick about seven plays that we read, and I'll take different ones, different years. But I try to show how each play is discussing a major question of political life, a major question of the good there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I want to have an example of that, but I also want to back up a little bit where you said politics, by definition, is living life together, and that actually rattled me a little bit because I go, that's ideally what I wish politics were, but it seems to be the antithesis of what politics are today.
Well, it doesn't mean we always get along while we live together. what it means is that human beings aren't meant to be alone or by themselves. They need community, and those communities need some way of organizing themselves, and that way should be justice and mercy and the good. And politics tries to answer and live out how do human beings live together in those ways. And sometimes the way we answer it in politics is bad. And you see, one example of that is I give the students the play Coriolanus, which is set in ancient Rome. And that is one where technically everyone lives in the city of Rome, but in reality, there's really at least two Romes. There's sort of a patrician, noble, elite Rome, and there's a commoner Rome, and both are pretty disordered. And part of their disordering means they're always at each other's throats. And I think one of the questions Shakespeare asks in that play that I ask my students is, what would a real united Rome look like? What would they have in common? What would justice be? And what is it about the people hating, the few, and the few hating the many, and the things they despise about each other? How does that show a disordered justice and a disordered political life?
So how would some of your C students respond? Because that's where I live, in the C student area.
Well, one great thing about Shakespeare is it's not just intellectual speeches. There's lots of war, lots of fighting, lots of romance. And really what I think
most of my students were able to see, for example, in that class, is that the few and the many each have flaws and they each have virtues. The few love honor and glory. They realize there's more to life than just eating and pleasure, which is sometimes what the many, the masses, you know, fall prey to in Shakespeare's plays. But what the few can show the many is that people actually do have bodies. They do have families. They do have, you know, the body and pleasure and food and all these things are goods, and that a full human being recognizes both. And I think what he shows is a fuller politics respects what the masses bring and what the few bring. And I think that's something that my students are able to get a decent sense of what a fuller politics is through, say, a play like that.
Mm-hmm. So, Adam, you take some of the topics that are going on in politics today and then lay them on the template of one of Shakespeare's plays. And how does it work? Because I'm fascinated by this. We've talked about this months and months ago, and I said, in the summertime, I want to have you talk Shakespeare with me.
Right, and absolutely. Things I try to point out, one is Coriolanus. I turn to that to ask the question of if you're having, you know, battles between elites, so-called elites, and the common man, what's going on under that? And I use Coriolanus as a way to get at that contemporary issue. Another thing I like to get at is in the play Othello, which is set in Venice, there is the issue of race. Mm-hmm. Othello is a Moor. There's explicit discussions of racial differences. And he has a trouble feeling like he's part of a community that doesn't look like him. Well, we're a country that's supposed to be built on bringing together all different kinds of races and nationalities, and that is a play that sort of cautions that might be a difficult thing to do. So I definitely try to bring in some contemporary issues as they come up, but show that almost anything that comes up now has been around. We kind of have particular manifestations of perpetual questions of how we should live together.
Yeah, we've been dealing with the same issues forever, haven't we? Nothing's new, is it?
No, there's nothing new under the sun. And I think one thing, though, I like about what I can do with Shakespeare is Shakespeare doesn't have the exact same view that many of my students do. You know, he lives in a world of kings, monarchs, and so I like to also present them with plays that sort of rattle their assumptions. So you get a play like Richard II, where, you know, at first the play seems to be attacking divine right of kings. How silly it is that someone would say God made me king with no input from the people, and therefore I can do whatever I want. But then what you see in the rest of that play is once Richard is dethroned, as he is in the play, things kind of go off the rails. And Shakespeare forces you to ask, well, I didn't like Richard because he was a tyrant, but what replaces it? What kind of political system comes in its place? And I think that I also like that it forces students a bit out of their comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. So, Adam, what would be your top three Shakespeare plays?
Oh, I was afraid you would ask that.
I'm sorry.
I'll do my top three for politics.
Okay, for politics.
There's plays like Much Ado About Nothing that I love, but I don't think are particularly political. I would say Henry V, which I think is one of Shakespeare's most positive portrayals of what a leader that leads the people, loves the people, looks like. Merchant of Venice, which I think does a masterful job in a courtroom scene of saying what happens when law, justice, and mercy aren't exactly the same. How do you put the three together? And then the third I would probably say is Julius Caesar, which really asks the question of if there is one great man in a republic, does that undermine whether a republic can be a government of, by, and for the people, or must you do something to get rid of that tyrant? What does politics look like under that situation?
Mm-hmm. So law, justice, and mercy, that's something you can apply to just about any political subject today, can't you?
Yes, and that's actually the famous courtroom scene where if people say about taking their pound of flesh.
Yeah.
It's where there's a contract made where one guy loans another money, and the other guy says, well, if I default on it, you can take a pound of my flesh. And because of the hatred between them, when that a loan is defaulted on, the other guy demands it because he knows it'll kill him. And there's this difficulty, because if you just throw the laws out the window, like in this case where there's a contract, then what holds the city together? But if you let someone take a pound of flesh, aren't you undermining justice and aren't you undermining mercy? And there's a great speech that is given in it where a woman disguised as a man so she can act as a lawyer comes in and displays that actually mercy is an essential part of politics. Yes, we want justice, but we also, because of the mistakes human makes, because of the sinfulness of human beings, we need to be merciful in our politics as God is merciful in his ways towards us.
Mm-hmm. And is that from The Merchant of Venice?
That is. It's Act 4, Scene 1. I actually was in a production of it this spring.
Were you really?
The students every year do what's called Shakespeare in the Arb, in the Arboretum, and they've let me two out of the last 3 years play a minor role in it. And I was in that scene, and that's great too, because he in that scene he sort of implies the need for women to be part of politics in a society where men are often the ones taking the lead. The women come in disguised as men and fix all the stuff the men have screwed up, which in my household, you know, is done without disguise. And it's just, I think, a really neat thing, because it doesn't deny that men and women are different. It actually just says a full politics includes all human beings, and men and women have something to contribute to a fuller view of justice.
Yeah. All right, Adam, let me take a little break. When we come back, more with Dr. Adam Carrington, professor of political science at Hillsdale College. We'll be right back. Fourteen minutes till the top of the hour. I'm in a conversation with Dr. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College, and he teaches a course on Shakespeare and politics, and we're chatting about that. Adam, it seems like there's a trend that colleges and universities are going away from teaching some of this great literature. What are some of the challenges that you see when it comes to teaching about a guy like Shakespeare?
Well, I will say at Hillsdale, we're refreshingly out of the norm. The students really adore doing this, and there's a lot of support from the institution. But in the broader, you're right, in the broader academy, there's, I think, two problems. One is a kind of what I think C.S. Lewis called a chronological snobbery, that the past is really a catalog of why we're better, why we're less bigoted, or why we're less evil or stupid or ignorant, which I think is foolish and silly. That there's great wisdom in the past. The other is, I think that there's a lot of rejection of Shakespeare and other such writers because instead of making diversity in the educational system a means of finding truth from different perspectives. That's what we try to do here at Hillsdale. You study the sciences, you study the humanities, you study the social studies, because those are all parts of a coherent truth. I think a lot of places have lost the idea that you can understand truth through any means, much less through plays and literature. And I think, you know, what's strange about it is you put these texts in front of students, and almost immediately they know that all that stuff is bunk. That when they read great literature, they see real people acting in real ways that really shine light on what it means to be a human being, and that if you get rid of all this extra stuff and just let them see what the beauty of a writer like Shakespeare, it's amazing what that can do to clear up some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'm starting to feel a little bit embarrassed, because it's like if I was given two choices, do you want to go watch Shakespeare in the park tonight, or do you want to sit home and watch Caddyshack again? I go, oh, don't give me those options.
I've watched Caddyshack and Shakespeare in the Park.
So there
are good things both ways.
Oh, good.
It doesn't mean you only have to read Shakespeare. Just like, you know, steak is good, but I love a hot dog as well.
Yeah, okay. All right.
And they all have their good. But no, Shakespeare isn't easy, but he's worth it. That's what I would say about him. He's not easy. He doesn't speak the way we do now.
Right.
Man, is he worth it.
Right.
When you see what he's doing. And he's genuinely funny. It's not, some people misunderstand him by standing with their hands raised and their chins up in a really dramatic pose. No, Shakespeare made, you know, bawdy jokes. He made high-minded jokes. He made deep philosophical ideas. He had slapstick comedy. He really painted a lot of life, and life is laughter and tears. It's seriousness and joking.
Mm-hmm. Is part of the problem for me, Adam, when you go see Shakespeare, like you said, it's Act Four, and there's three intermissions, and you're at the theater for 4.5 hours, and I can't stay awake for 4.5 hours in the theater.
Sure. That's difficult. In fact, there was this story that just came out that there's a production of Henry IV being done in Los Angeles where one of the funnier characters, Falstaff, is played now I'm blanking on his name in the middle of the interview. I apologize.
That's all right. What else was he in? Did that help at all?
Tom Hanks. Goodness.
Oh, Tom Hanks. There you
go. I apologize.
That's all right.
I cannot remember Tom Hanks.
He's an unknown actor.
Yeah, someone passed out in the play, and while they were attending to him or her, Tom Hanks jumps out in character and ad libs some monologue, insulting the crowd. I think Shakespeare. And one thing I would say, it's not cheating to watch the movie.
Okay.
These are made to be performed. You're not cheating by doing that. And I think find a good production where the actors really try to communicate what's going on, and you'll be amazed how much you understand. Sometimes it's the actor's fault that they don't communicate well enough what's going on in Shakespeare. They make it too stiff. They don't make it lively enough.
Interesting. Adam, talk a little bit about the biblical references in Shakespeare.
Oh, they're everywhere. And it really shows that he grew up in a very biblically literate culture where you could make references and not even say they're biblical references and people knew them. And, one of them is in The Merchant of Venice where they talk about the nature of mercy and connect it to biblical passages. You see in many of the history plays that are set in England, Henry V talks theology persistently throughout the plays. And I think what you really see is what a biblically literate culture it is, that the Psalms, Proverbs, references to the Gospels are made really in almost any play that is set in a Christian context. Really, the only ones they don't show up in are the ones that are set in, say, ancient Rome, pre-Christian, or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. So, when your students show up for class and have they come from a background of studying Shakespeare prior to this? I'm just curious. I find this fascinating.
It varies. I mean, most of my Shakespeare education pre-college was self-taught. I got interested in it, and I, you know, clawed my way through it. Some students got a better education than I did on that score. Some are coming to it for the first time and are, you know, I've had students come to me and say, I'm really intimidated by this. I'm really worried about how this is going to go. But it's amazing that what some tenacity and interest and love of language, where it gets you. And I find that even the students who are worried or put off or concerned really start to get it toward the end and really start to see what's going on in the text. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's a real joy of teaching, to watch that come together.
If someone has never studied Shakespeare or read much of it, where would you suggest they start?
I think Julius Caesar would not be a bad one, because most people kind of know the story, and I think the language is not among the most intricate, and it's not the most there's not as much wordplay. I think I would start with that, and then possibly a comedy like Much Ado About Nothing, where there's a lot of focus on a romance, and that romance has a lot of wit, but also I think is pretty approachable. And then I might say, if not that, Romeo and Juliet, because people are so familiar with the story. And again, I think knowing the basic storyline is a pretty pretty good jumping off point to trying to get it. And the more you do it, the easier it gets, and the more you're able to get out of the text once you see them in play.
Mm-hmm. All right, Adam, before I let you go, I would love just to, because this is such a busy month for Supreme Court decisions, I'd just love for you to comment a little bit on how we must be defending our freedom of speech.
Yes, we still have a couple of decisions on that yet to come out, and I think the Masterpiece Cake Shop case was a bit of a wash. And so I think that, speech is an essential part of being political, and it's mm-hmm. an essential part of being religious, too, that you know, the God who speaks has us speak and has us speak politically and religiously. And I think that the courts have still yet to decide some fundamental questions of how well our speech as religious and political beings is protected, which itself is an important part of protecting us living more fully human lives.
Mm-hmm. And you think did you say you thought the Masterpiece Cake Shop was a wash?
A bit of, well, and I think because they dodged the major issues. They said that the main reason that the baker should win is that in trying his case, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission showed too much animus toward him.
Okay.
But they explicitly said, we're not saying if they didn't do this, what the result would be. They've said, you could, if you're respectful toward religion, the religious arguments may still lose. And that's where I think a later case is still needs to decide the fundamental free speech and free exercise questions that were brought up there but not settled one way or another. So it's much better than had the court decided against the baker, but they didn't give a full, robust protection of him yet either. I think that's coming one way or another in a future case.
Okay, and there was a case recently, Sveen versus Mellon.
Yes, I actually wrote an article on that piece in the Washington Examiner, and that's not so much about free speech, but about the fact that there's a clause in the Constitution called the Contracts Clause, which says that the government can't step in and change the terms of a contract you've entered into. And, you know, the bigger point is think about how much of your life is bound up in contracts. When you go to a restaurant, when you buy a house, when you buy a car, when you buy clothes, even marriages are contracts. And a lot of our stability and a lot of the protection of our lives are based in contracts being enforced, agreements being kept. And I think that this case, I don't know if we have time to go into the details, but I think this case was trying to protect contractual relationships, and I'm not so sure the court did a good job of keeping the government from changing contracts that people have entered into.
So we've got about 2 minutes, 1 minute left. Just give us a quick synopsis of what the government was trying to do. What was it? Was an 8-1 Supreme Court decision, and the dissenter was Justice Gorsuch.
Yeah, and this actually came out of Minnesota, was where this case came out of. And what it is a married couple agreed that the husband made the wife a beneficiary of his life insurance policy. They then were divorced, but after he was divorced, he didn't change who the beneficiary of it was, and then died. Well, Minnesota law says if you get a divorce, then unless you rename your ex as a beneficiary, it's automatically voided. And so that was the violation of the contract.
All right.
The majority said no, and I think Gorsuch had the better of the argument.
Thanks so much, Adam. I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll be back with our. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.